Welcome to Base by Base, the paper cast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app.
Okay, let's unpack this core biological paradox. How do you run a highly dynamic, responsive operation like, say, gene expression in a microscopic room that is packed solid?
It's the ultimate spatial problem. I mean, your entire genome, something like 2 meters of DNA, is stuffed into a nucleus that's smaller than a grain of salt.
Right.
To fit, it gets organized into what we call chromatin, winding around proteins to form these units called nucleosomes, and then this chromatin condenses even further.
And it takes on this highly concentrated liquid-like phase, almost like a tiny droplet of ultra-dense material.
Exactly, like a drop of oil in water.
So when we say ultra-dense, we mean that if you were a regulatory enzyme, trying to navigate this would feel like, I don't know, trying to run through heavy-set molasses.
For sure. You'd assume the whole thing just locks up, stiffens, and prevents any access. It should effectively shut down all gene activity.
But it doesn't. Precisely. If that dense chromatin droplet behaved like a rigid gel, cellular life would just halt. So the cell has to engineer a way to maintain this incredible fluidity and dynamics, even inside this condensed phase.
And that liquidity is what keeps the genes accessible.
Right. So the burning question, and this is what this deep dive is all about, is what are the specific molecular factors that actually initiate this condensation, and which ones act as the physical, you know, lubricants to make sure it all stays dynamic inside?
It really sounds like they are trying to understand the material science of our own DNA packaging. That's where we're headed today.
Absolutely. We are looking at the biophysical regulators of chromatin condensation.
This deep dive required some truly rigorous work. Today, we celebrate the research of Jia Gao, Hongyun Li, Song Tan, Robo Zhu, and Tai He Li from the Pennsylvania State University.
They've really advanced our understanding of chromatin dynamics and condensation.
Their study, titled Roles of Histone Chaperone NAP1 and Histone Acetylation in Regulating Phase Separation of Nucleosome Arrays, was published in Nature Communications on 27 November 2025.
And it's a masterful piece of quantitative biology. It really merges material science techniques with genetics.
So to set the context for anyone joining us, let's quickly define the fundamentals. When we talk about chromatin, we're talking about DNA wrapped around histone proteins.
The fundamental repeating unit is the nucleosome.
Like beads on a string.
Right, that's the classic analogy. That bead is the nucleosome. About 150 base pairs of DNA wrapped around an octamer core of 4 pairs of histone proteins. You have 2 H2A H2B dimers and a central H3 H4 tetramer.
And importantly, each histone protein has a tail that kind of sticks out.
And those tails are critical. They're major regulatory targets.
So what we've learned recently is that arrays of these nucleosomes, when you get them concentrated enough, they just spontaneously aggregate.
They undergo what's called liquid-liquid phase separation, or LOPS. It's the same physical principle that makes oil separate from vinegar. But here, it's the chromatin separating from the rest of the nuclear liquid.
And the experimental setup they used is just beautifully representative of what happens in a real cell.
It is. They took these 12 mer nucleosome arrays and in vitro concentrated them just a bit. And under those conditions, they spontaneously form liquid droplets with a nucleosome concentration of about 326 micromolar.
Which is the exact density we see in the transcriptionally repressed parts of a living cell nucleus.
So it's a perfect platform to test all the biological controls.
And traditionally, we know you can regulate gene accessibility in a couple of ways. First is adding or removing chemical tags, what we call histone post-translational modifications, or PTMs.
Right, and this study focused specifically on acetylation of the histone N-terminal tails, especially on H3 and H4. Acetylation basically neutralizes the positive charge on those histones.
And second, there are these regulatory proteins, specifically histone chaperones like NAP1, which kind of mediate the structural interactions between the DNA and the histones.
Yes.
But up until now, we understood that these factors affected the biochemistry, you know, whether a gene was accessible. The physical question they tackled here is, I think, much deeper.
It is. They're asking, do these factors stop the droplet from forming altogether? Or do they just change the mechanical properties, the actual viscosity and movement, once the droplet has formed?
And that requires a material science approach.
Exactly. I mean, to measure the material properties of a tiny liquid droplet, you can't just use standard biochemical assays. You need techniques that can probe structure and movement right down to the nanoscale.
And they truly didn't rely on just one measurement. They used a tripartite approach. Let's start with the standard measure of internal dynamics, FRAP.
Right, fluorescence recovery after photobleaching. FRAP is the classic technique here. They bleach the fluorescent tag on the nucleosomes inside the droplet.
So they just zap it with a laser.
Zap it with a laser, and then they measure the time it takes for new, unbleached fluorescent material to diffuse back into that bleached area. A fast recovery time means the material is highly mobile, very fluidic.
And a slow recovery means it's stiff or locked up.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
But as we'll see, the FRAP data was only giving them a partial answer. They needed a much clearer picture of the droplet's internal structure.
Which is why they deployed STORM.
Stochastic optical reconstruction microscopy. It's a super resolution imaging technique. It lets them visualize the structural organization inside the droplet at a much, much higher resolution than standard microscopy.
And that was crucial for confirming a major hypothesis, right? Whether the droplet was homogeneous or if it had different mobile and immobile parts.
Exactly. And the third technique is what really elevated this study into the realm of biophysics. Microfology using optical tweezers.
Okay, this is the really cool one.
This is the most rigorous measurement. Rheology is the study of how materials flow and deform. So what they did was embed a tiny polystyrene bead, a physical probe, inside the chromatin droplet.
And then they used the optical tweezers to basically grab it and wiggle it back and forth.
They sinusoidally oscillate the bead. They're shaking this bead and measuring how the chromatin droplet resists that motion.
I see.
And from that, they measured the resulting viscoelasticity, which breaks down into two measures, the storage modulus and the loss modulus.
Okay, let's break that down.
Think of it this way. The storage modulus measures the elastic component, how much the material acts like a spring, storing energy. The loss modulus measures the viscous component, how much it acts like honey, dissipating energy as heat.
So by separating those two, they could quantify the viscosity and, crucially, the relaxation times.
And the relaxation time is essentially the time it takes for the material to bounce back or adjust after you poke it.
And the fact that they identified two distinct relaxation times confirmed that the droplet wasn't uniform.
It had two physically distinct components responding at different speeds. That's a powerful piece of evidence. It connects the structure they saw in STORM to the mechanical properties they measured with the tweezers.
Okay, let's turn to the gold, the core findings that establish these physical mechanisms. The study first focused on H4, and the results were just unequivocal about its role.
The histone H4 tail, specifically its positively charged lysine residues, emerged as the absolute LOPS initiator, the driver. They found that if they chemically simulated H4 tail acetylation, droplet formation stopped entirely.
Let's define that simulation because it's a key piece of evidence. They used a mutation called H4KQ.
That's right. Histone tails are rich in positively charged lysine residues, which we symbolize as K. Acetylation adds a neutral acetyl group, and that removes the positive charge, which dramatically reduces the attraction between nucleosomes.
So in the H4KQ mutant, they just swapped the charged lysine K for a neutral glutamine Q.
Permanently mimicking the effect of full acetylation. And the result of losing that positive charge was a binary switch. The droplets simply would not form, even at high concentrations.
So the H4 tail charge is the on-in switch for chromatin condensation.
You neutralize H4, the gate slams shut, condensation doesn't happen.
But, and this is so cool, the H3 tail behaved totally differently. It gives the cell two distinct mechanisms of control.
It did. They created the H3KQ mimic and also used histone acyl transferase, or HAT enzymes, to acetylate the H3 tail in situ. And H3 acetylation did not block droplet formation. The droplet still condensed.
But once they formed, they were materially different.
Significantly more fluidic. The FRAP recovery time was at least twofold faster compared to the wild type arrays. So H3 acetylation isn't a binary switch, it's a rheostat, a dimmer. It's adjusting the viscosity without preventing the initial condensation.
And this fluidizing effect supports the idea that the droplet isn't one homogeneous liquid. We already know the FRAP recovery was limited, right? Something like 50 to 60%.
Exactly. They never achieved 100% recovery.
Why not?
That limited recovery strongly suggested that a big chunk of the chromatin was static, or at least moving too slowly to recover within the measurement window.
And the STORM imaging confirmed this.
Confirmed this structural heterogeneity, yes. The condensed droplets contain a highly mobile fraction nucleosomes just zipping around, and a relatively immobile structural scaffold. These are clusters of nucleosomes that stay fixed on a 10-second timescale.
So you've got two layers of organization, a fixed framework for stability, and a fast-moving component ensuring liquidity. Now let's bring in the chaperone, NAP1.
Okay.
Does it act on the fixed framework or the mobile traffic?
NAP1 is fascinating because it seems to manage both the fluidity and the stability. First, they showed NAP1 could take solid, gel-like aggregates and just dissolve them, which suggests it actively prevents the network from locking up.
And when they added it to normal wild-type droplets?
It made them much more fluidic, mirroring the effect of H3 acetylation. But here's the counterintuitive part.
Go on.
NAP1 significantly increased the nucleosome concentration inside the droplets. It pushed the density from 326 micromolar to a staggering 491.
Wait, so if you pack something tighter, standard physics would suggest it should get slower and stiffer. Why did NAP1 make this denser material more dynamic?
That's the critical paradox this study illuminates. NAP1 is likely acting as a specialized lubricant right at the point of contact between nucleosomes. By facilitating DNA histone dynamics, letting the links rapidly break and reform, it prevents the formation of permanent, high-friction, gel-like bonds.
So NAP1 isn't just squeezing the liquid, it's like it's coating the internal links with Teflon.
That's a perfect analogy. It elevates the thermodynamic stability of the nucleosomes, allowing them to pack closer without increasing the internal resistance or friction.
And we know it's not the initiator.
We know it isn't because, crucially, it still failed to induce LOPS in the H4KQ arrays. This cements the conclusion. H4 is the driver, while NAP1 is the stability and fluidity enhancer.
Okay, so let's tie this all back to the most rigorous data. The microrheology. Since we established there are two components, a fast one and a slow one, which one did NAP1 and H3 acetylation actually affect?
The microrheology analysis, with its two relaxation components, a fast one on the millisecond scale for the mobile fraction, and a slow one on the 100 millisecond to second scale for the structural scaffold, it gave us the answer.
And
NAP1 and H3KQ specifically and significantly lowered the viscosity and shortened the relaxation time of the slower component.
That's the key connection. They are not just lubricating the free-moving molecules, they are actively changing the physical mechanical resistance of the structural scaffold itself.
They're making the fixed framework easier for things to push through.
So if we look at the implications of all this, it paints a really clear picture of differentiated chromatin regulation.
It really does. H4 tail acetylation provides the binary switch.
Mm.
It acts on that positive charge to just veto the formation of the condensed phase entirely. It's the gatekeeper.
While H3 tail acetylation and NAP1, they act as rheostats, the fluidity dial. Once the chromatin is condensed, they regulate the internal environment. They actively lower the viscosity and speed up the dynamics within that dense structure.
And this enhanced fluidity is profoundly important for gene expression. It means that large regulatory proteins, you know, like RNA polymerase 2-sec and various chromatin remodelers, they don't have to wait for the entire condensed structure to melt to get to a target gene.
They can navigate the dense regions much more efficiently.
Far more efficiently, because the structural scaffold itself is being dynamically managed.
So NAP1 isn't just facilitating assembly, it's actively promoting a dynamic environment by helping this DNA histone network reconfigure itself on the timescale of just a few hundred milliseconds.
This is a newly defined function for NAP1 in condensed chromatin. It's the traffic controller in the density.
There was another fascinating dynamic they uncovered, right? About spontaneous histone exchange.
Yes. When they compared FRAP recovery of arrays labeled on H2B versus H4, the H2B labeled arrays recovered faster.
Meaning the H2A, H2B dimers are swapping out more quickly than the core H3, H4 tetramer.
Exactly. This spontaneous H2A, H2B dimer exchange is happening even within the structural scaffold. This gives the cell an intrinsic mechanism for histone turnover, constantly cycling out histones that might be damaged or modified.
Even in dense, transcriptionally silent regions, that's built-in structural maintenance.
It's critical. But the authors did acknowledge some limitations, particularly around the use of the broad histone acetyl transferase complexes, the HATs.
Right.
While the results are clear, the exact locations and the full extent of acetylation achieved by those HAT complexes weren't fully defined. So future work will definitely need to nail down the precise dynamics of specific H2A, H2B variants to really capture how all these biophysical mechanisms intersect.
So what does this all mean for us? The central insight is that chromatin condensation into liquid droplets is driven primarily by the positive charges on the histone H4 tail. That's the structural anchor.
But once that anchor is set, the internal accessibility dynamics of that dense chromatin are actively regulated by histone H3 tail acetylation and the histone chaperone NAP1.
This is the mechanism the cell uses to turn a dense structural scaffold into a dynamically fluid environment,
allowing rapid gene access even when the DNA is highly packed.
So given that this internal fluidity is key to enzyme access, what does this understanding of the mechanical properties, the viscosity and structural resistance mean for designing next generation drugs? If we can design molecules that mimic H3 acetylation or NAP1 activity, could we effectively lubricate specific, previously inaccessible silenced regions like those involved in tumor suppression to force their reactivation? It raises a whole new avenue for targeting the physical rather than just the chemical state of the genome.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
With a moving face, snap one near the bonds unbind. It's